considerably. He mapped out a day trip for us this Saturday, using Fairford as our starting point, since it's one of the first places we will pass coming up from London. I know Fairford isn't right. Somehow I know it's not. But we have to begin somewhere. I am both eager and hesitant to look for the bride's box, Emmy. It seems like the honorable thing to do. I hope God in heaven will look down on me and favor me with success. It seems such a little thing to request of him. Simon asked me if I am going to tell Granny what I am doing. I don't think I will. All of this happened between you and me before I knew her. She can't help. And if I told her and then failed, she would know I tried, and I would see my failure in her eyes every time we visited, and she asked me how I was. This is between you and me. Julia. July 5th, 1958. Dear Emmy, Simon and I are back from our first trip out to look for Aunt Charlotte's house. He is heating up soup for us to eat as I write to you. We are cold and soaked to the skin. The day dawned with sprinkles and then switched to rain just as we arrived in Fairford and began our first inquiries. It didn't occur to us until we were underway that we could expect no help from city officials in these towns because it was Saturday. No city offices would be open. But Simon said not to worry. City officials might have been hesitant anyway to speak to two strangers asking about sisters whose last name they didn't even know. The Fairford train station didn't look anything like what I remembered. We didn't even get out of the car. We drove on to Kempsford, where we got thoroughly drenched, finding out there was no railway station there. We tried Lechlade and then Burford because it was nearby, even though it's in Oxfordshire, not Gloucestershire. And then back in the car to Burton-on-the-Water, a beautiful little place. I was so taken with it that Simon suggested we should ask about the sisters in the druggists and the beauty shop and at the park. I decided that when I asked about Charlotte, I would say only that I wished to find my foster mother and thank her for taking my sister and me in, all those many years ago. Don't you think other evacuees have done this, Emmy? Gone back to the homes and mothers and fathers and siblings who sheltered them during the war years? I think they do. And this seemed to me a very polite and respectable reason for snooping about and asking strangers to tell me whether a Charlotte and Rose live, or lived, nearby. So that is what I did. I asked people, mostly older folks, if they knew of two sisters named Charlotte and Rose, because I had spent nearly 3 months with them at the start of the war before my mother died. There are a great many souls in Boughton-on-the-Water, and the surrounding little towns that took in evacuees, Emmy. But no one remembers a pair of grey-haired sisters named Charlotte and Rose. We also tried at Upper and Little Risington, tiny little villages brimming with houses made of Cotswold stone, because they are within a manageable walking distance of Boughton. I remember that you and I walked from Charlotte's house to a train station the morning we returned to London. It was a long walk, and you carried me part of the way. It was dark, and I was tired. Simon thinks it can't have been more than 6 or so miles that we walked, because I was too young to walk farther than that in the middle of the night, and I was too heavy for you to carry the entire way. But we found no one in these towns who knew the sisters. Still, we drove down some of the lanes, looking at the houses, mostly all made of the same stone, and reminding me very much of Charlotte's house. We didn't find it. But I am strangely encouraged. The sense of the familiar was too strong, Emmy. Julia. July 12, 1958. Dear Emmy, we went out again today. This time we made our way to Chipping Campden, which didn't look familiar at all when we first drove into town, and I had to remind myself that nearly 20 years have passed since the day you and I arrived in Gloucestershire. But as we neared the city centre, I began to think perhaps we were to be lucky today. The railway station and the lay of the streets and the city hall, it addled my brain how familiar and yet not familiar they were. Again we asked about in the shops and the library and the bank if anyone knew of the sisters. We received mostly kind and compassionate responses. A few people looked askance at us, or simply shook their heads with a wordless no when we asked. We had tea at a lovely cafe to refresh us, and Simon noted on the map how many villages were within walking distance. And we went to them all, Emmy. Aston Subage, Broad Marston, several others. Every place looked like it could have been where you and I were, and yet no one knew of the sisters. We even strolled the cemeteries looking for their names. On the way home, I was feeling tremendously discouraged. I wondered aloud if perhaps Thea had been wrong about where Mum told her we were. Maybe she assumed it was Gloucestershire, or maybe Thea said we had been in Oxfordshire, and Granny heard Gloucestershire, because there are Cotswold villages in Oxfordshire as well. Simon just said, rather confidently, "Well, then we'll look in every village in Oxfordshire too." The way he said this gave me pause. I couldn't see his face clearly, because night had fallen, and the only light on his features was from the headlamps of a few passing cars. But in the shadows, I saw a determined look that surprised me. It did not matter to him that the search may have now widened to include another county. It only mattered that we pressed on, like a wise accountant would do, to find the error in the ledger and adjust it. It was as if he was determined to find the house to fix me, which is different than the reason I want to find it. He wanted to find the house so that I could at last climb out of my regrets and marry him. I am not interested in fixing me. I want to fix what I broke. It's completely different. When I said nothing, he took my silence for anxiety. That now we have even more towns to search, and that he might lose interest in me because of it. He said not to worry, because I was the only thing that mattered to him. He reached for my hand. I love him, Emmy, I do. And I know he loves me. But sitting there in the dark, with the shimmer of London way off in the distance, I knew I must continue on alone. If I don't, I fear I am the one who may lose interest. I don't want to feel as if I am the broken thing that needs to be repaired, even if that's what I am. Your lover should see you as whole, even if you are in pieces, because that's what love does, doesn't it? It sees past the flaws. It forgets there are flaws. Simon said my name. I traced his hand in mine, wondering how to tell him. Simon, I said, would you mind very much if next Saturday I went alone? What was that? He said. I proceeded to tell him that finding the bride's box was something I needed to accomplish on my own. I figured the word accomplish would sound good to his ears. I didn't think he needed to know that I was feeling he was showing less love for me rather than more by his ardent enthusiasm for the quest. That would only wound him. And there are already enough wounds in the world. I told him I appreciated with all my heart the help and support he had given me, but that I wanted to continue on my own. "But are you sure that's a good idea?" he asked, "going alone." I think he was suggesting that in my fragile state, maybe I would collapse at the shock of finding the house and the box, or be devastated at not finding them. But I have survived much, Emmy, haven't I? Haven't I survived the war and the loss of my childhood, my parents, and my sister? Haven't I come back to London? Haven't I looked for you? Haven't I agreed to write this journal? Haven't I embarked on the mission to find your brides? And haven't I done all that alone? I squeezed Simon's hand. This is something only I can do for me, Simon, I said. I will be all right. He attempted a couple more counter-arguments, but in the end, because he loves me, he agreed. I asked him if I could use his car, which he has loaned to me other times, and he said of course. He seemed a little hurt when we said goodnight, but I don't think he feels injured by me. It's more that he's disappointed he can't be the one to rescue me. I think I know how that feels. Julia. Chapter 39. July 19th, 1958. Dear Emmy. Emmy, I think I found the town where we got off the train and Charlotte met us. When I drove into Morton in Marsh today, I felt as though I were being tugged through a tunnel. I was shaking when I parked Simon's car and walked into the train station. The station itself didn't seem familiar to me, but walking out of it and back onto the street nearly took my breath away. The scene in front of me was like a long-lost photograph that flitted down off a shelf in my mind. It was the same, but different. As I walked up the sidewalk toward the town center, I could see you and me, holding our cardboard boxes with our gas masks inside. I could feel the weight of my fairy tale book tucked under my arm. I could feel my hand in yours. There was a dead bird in the street, and the boys ahead of us from my school wanted to stop and poke it. They were daring me to touch it. You kicked it with the tip of your shoe, and it flopped over into the gutter. Oh, Emmy, the pull of feeling you so near almost yanked me to the ground. This was the place. I knew it. The first few people I approached in the grocery store and the stationers seemed dubious when I told them whom I was looking for and why, and I realized I was talking too fast and too frantically. I must have seemed like a madwoman escaped from an institution, intent on hacking to death the two sisters I was searching for. I knew I needed to compose myself, and I needed to sit down with the map and see where you and I could have come from that long-ago morning when we walked to Morton. Charlotte didn't live here. She lived somewhere else. But I was close. I went to a cafe, ordered a pot of Darjeeling, and used the warmth and floral notes of the tea to calm myself as I studied the map. I made a list of towns that you and I could have walked from to reach Morton. Batsford, Draycott, Boughton-on-the-Hill, Lockley, Chastleton, Broadwell, Longborough, Stow-in-the-Wold, Oddington. I drank my tea, got back in Simon's car, and headed to the northwest corner of my search area to work my way down. So today, I only got to explore Batsford, Blockley, Boughton-on-the-Hill, and the smaller hamlets Paxton and Aston Magna. I did not find the house, and I did not see the sisters' names in the local cemeteries. I started home for London when the sun was setting, and drove to Simon's flat so that he could take me home and have his car. He seemed a little sad that I'd so quickly discovered Morton on my own. Not sad for me, but for himself. It was obvious that he wished he had chosen Morton the first day out. "Still want to go alone next Saturday?" he asked. Maybe I should have invited him to come. I could tell he wanted to, but I kissed him and declined. I like that it's just me. Next Saturday I will head for Chastleton, Broadwell, and Longborough. July 26, 1958. Dear Emmy, I am sick with some kind of flu. It's Saturday, but instead of getting into Simon's car and continuing my search, I am spending the day in bed with a fever. Granny insisted on coming out on the train to take care of me when I came home ill from work on Thursday, even though I was far from needing that much attention. I haven't been out to see Granny and Gramps much since I started dating Simon. I think she was looking for a reason to come see me, and to see how Simon and I are getting on. I'm 25 and never really had a boyfriend before. She and Grams have met Simon only once, when he and I drove out to have Sunday dinner with them a few months ago. That was before Simon proposed to me and tried to offer me a ring, and I told him I wasn't ready. No one really knows he did that. Well, maybe his parents do. I don't have many close friends at work, or here in my building. I haven't wanted to trust many people with my friendship, I guess because of how awful my teenage years were. So I don't have chummy girlfriends to confide in. Maybe if I had a best friend, I would have told her Simon had proposed. I don't really have one of those. Simon is my best friend. You can see how terrible it will be for me if he loses interest in me. He says he won't, but I wonder how he knows he can wait for me. He's never done this before. Granny stayed for 2 days, made me loads of soup, did my laundry, and went to the pharmacy for cough syrup. She asked more than once what I've been up to in my free time. I think she is wondering why I've not been home on Saturdays when she is called. I almost told her what I've been doing. I'm not sure why I didn't. Other than she'd worry that I'll wish I hadn't looked for the bride's box when it's all said and done, whether I find it or not. She left this afternoon on the 5 o'clock train back to Oxford. Simon is coming over in a little while, to read to me and fuss over me, no doubt. I just want to shake this bug and get back to what I was doing before I got sick. I am close. I can feel it. Julia. August 2nd, 1958. My dear Emmy, I am not sure how to put into words what I am feeling. I am still a bit dazed. Numb, really. I don't feel at all like I thought I would. I found Aunt Charlotte's house today, but not the bride's box. I was inside the bedroom you and I shared. I found the crawl space. I opened the door that had been painted shut. It wasn't there. I am back home now, sitting in my flat and watching the telly with Simon. He's afraid to leave, thinking it will dawn on me after he goes. But the bride's box is lost to me forever, and the last little bit of you with it. But I am strangely numb. I found the village to which Charlotte first took us to get library books. It's Stow-on-the-Wold, and it's 4 miles from Moreton-in-Marsh. I didn't remember the name of this little town, but when I saw the church, and the library, and even the post office, I knew this was the village Charlotte had called her own, and you and I had been to it, many times. I started out by going into the library, mainly because I remembered it. I asked the more mature of the two librarians if there was an older woman in the village named Charlotte, in her 80s perhaps. "You mean Charlotte Havelock?" the librarian replied. I felt silly not knowing her last name, so I just asked if this Charlotte Havelock had a sister named Rose. The librarian said yes, she did. Oh, Emmy, how my heart thumped in my chest as I asked where I could find them. She said she was sorry to tell me they were both deceased. She had attended Charlotte's funeral just 3 months ago. Rose died several years before that. 3 months, Emmy. Charlotte was alive 3 months ago. I had to sit down for a moment to let that sink in. I knew no good would come from pondering why I hadn't begun the search sooner. But how could I not lament having just missed her? The librarian felt bad for me and wanted to know if she could get me anything. I told her I just needed to know if Charlotte's house was still standing. She answered with a nod, and told me she'd heard an American woman and her daughter were living there, at least for the summer. The woman was distantly related to Charlotte, or something like that. She asked if I wanted directions to Thistle House. Charlotte's house has a name, Thistle House. You probably remember that. You probably remember everything. It didn't take long to drive the half mile to the house. The moment I was standing outside it, it was as if the years had rolled back like a curtain, and you and I were arriving on that first day. I knocked, and the door was opened by a teenage girl. She asked if she could help me. Her American accent was strange to hear coming from that threshold. I told her that I had lived in this house during the war, when it belonged to Charlotte Havelock. And then I asked if her parents were home. She said her father was still in the States, and her mother wasn't due back until the evening. I was so deeply disappointed. To have come that far, to have actually found the house, only to have to leave and come back another time was crushing. I pulled a grocery receipt out of my handbag and scribbled my name and phone number on it. I asked the girl if she wouldn't mind giving my name and number to her mother when she got home, and asking her to give me a ring. "Does my mother know you?" she asked. I told her she didn't. And then who knows why I did what I did next. I just blurted it all out, Emmy. I told the girl about you and your bride sketches, and what I had done with them on the night we ran away from Thistle House. I told her how you and I were separated on the first night of the Blitz, and that I was whisked away to America by a grandmother I didn't even know I had, and that I never saw or heard from you again. The girl's eyes were rimmed with tears when I was done, and I realized with a shock that so were mine. I began to apologize profusely when she opened the door wide and told me to come and see if the bride's box was still there. I didn't think I should, with her mum not at home, but the girl said I looked harmless enough. I'm not sure I should, I said. I am plenty old enough to take care of myself. Come in. So I did. She told me her name was Gwen. Emmy, from what I can remember, the house looks the same. The same furniture. The same green sofa in the living room. The same oak kitchen table. The same red carpet on the stairs. And the same creak as we ascended them. So you're related to the Havelock sisters? I asked, babbling as we climbed to calm myself. Gwen shrugged and said she wasn't really sure how they were related. She said her mother was born in England, but she moved to America when she married her father. Gwen said she didn't know very much about her mother's side of the family, because they were all deceased, and her mother never wanted to talk about them. We got to the top of the stairs, and I saw bursts of yellow. The room we slept in is still lemon-hued. The two twin beds are gone. And now there are a settee and two armchairs upholstered in checked canary yellow. My gaze was immediately drawn to the far wall, where the lace-covered table had been. A bookcase is there now. I told Gwen the crawl space was behind the bookcase, and she didn't hesitate. She walked right over to it and started to pull books off the shelves so that we could shimmy it away from the wall. As we worked, I asked her if this was her first time to England, and she said yes. Thistle House had been left to her mother when Charlotte Havelock died, and they were just staying the summer. Home and her father were in Minnesota. I asked if she liked it here. She said if she were allowed to go anywhere or do anything, she might like it. She said her mother worries too much about her, and it drives her crazy. I felt sorry for her. She reminded me a little of you, Emmy. I'm not sure why. Maybe because she seemed so eager to be grown up, and to make her own decisions. I asked her how old she was, and she said nearly 13. When we had removed enough of the books, we pushed the bookcase out of the way, and there it was. The crawl space door, painted shut. Gwen ran downstairs and quickly came back with a screwdriver. Before I could ask if her mum would want her to, she started to pry the painted seam open. The seal broke with a cracking pop. Gwen pulled the door open and then sat back. She told me to go ahead and see. My pulse was drumming as I crawled halfway in and reached up above the doorframe. I felt dust and cobwebs and droppings, but no box. No box. Gwen ran downstairs again and returned with a torch. She asked if she could give it a try. I worked my way out and she crawled in, clicking on the light as she went. I could see the beam dancing on the confines of the little space. I told her I had placed the box on the ledge on the inside of the doorframe. She swung the light around to shine it on the backside of where the door and the wall met. It wasn't there. She crawled out again, and we both sat there, looking at the dark space we had unearthed. Sorry, Gwen finally said. I was sorry, too. The numbness was already settling on me, like a heavy coat against wintry gusts that would chill to the bone if they could get to you. We closed the door and returned the bookcase to its rightful place, and the books to their shelves. Then we went back downstairs. There didn't seem to be a reason to stay, so I thanked her again and asked her if she was going to get in trouble for having let me in. She shrugged like she didn't care. I told her I'd be happy to talk with her mother by phone and let her know how kind and helpful she had been, but she just smiled and said I didn't have to do that. I told her to give her mother my name and number, just the same. When I left, she was standing at the door, watching me drive away. She's not going to give her mum that piece of paper with my name and phone number on it. That girl is just like you were, Emmy, wanting to make her own way in life, and the world isn't willing to grant her that freedom. I guess I am just like her, too. When I got home and told Simon what had happened, he asked me what I was going to do now. I know what he meant. He wants to know what this means for us. I can't answer him. I feel as if I am underwater, suspended, hovering between where I was and where I want to be. I am in no place to decide. I am sorry I lost your brides, Emmy. I am so very sorry. Julia.
Chapter 40. August 5th, 1958.
Dear Emmy, I am trying very hard to do what I said I would do, and that is live with the fact that the bride's box is gone. I told Dr. Diamon before I started looking that I would be okay with not finding it. I told Simon the same thing. Simon said this evening he wished he had talked me out of looking. But then I would always wonder, I said. And he said sometimes, wondering is better than knowing. Dr. Diamon told me truth is a strange companion. It devastates one moment and enthralls the next. But it never deceives. And because of that, in the end, it comforts. Julia. August 7th, 1958. Dear Emmy, I think we might be done here. Simon thinks it might be a good idea to lay you to rest. He wonders if maybe I could use this journal to memorialize you. I could burn it, and its ashes could be your remains. He read in an article that people who grieve the loss of a loved one, where there is no body, often need something to burn or bury to find ultimate release. That's how we say goodbye to people. We clasp them to our chest, weep over their lifeless form, and then send them back to the earth. I could do that with this journal. I need to ask Dr. Diamon what she thinks. Julia. August 11th, 1958. Dear Emmy, Dr. Diamon says the journal is mine to do with as I want. The journal has always been more about me than you. Isn't that funny? Here I am writing all these words to you, words you will never read. And it's not a problem, because the journal has always been for me. I don't think I can toss this into the fireplace. Not yet, anyway. But I think I can be finished with writing in it. We are done, aren't we, Emmy? I did all that I could to find you. All that I could to restore to you what I took from you. Dr. Diamon assures me that with all that I have told her about you, you would have forgiven me. That you did forgive me. I think maybe if we ended here, perhaps I can learn to believe it. Maybe not as quickly as Simon would like, but if I know anything about time, it is that it stretches to walk with you when you grieve. The rest of the world may zoom past at breakneck speed, but when you are learning to live with loss, time slows to the pace of your breathing. I will never forget you, Emmy. But I need to release you. Your sister always, Julia. August 15th, 1958. Emmy, I can hardly believe what has happened. Gwen found the bride's box. She found it. In Rose's old room. She called me this morning as I was getting ready for work. I am stunned beyond words. She wants to meet me in Stowe to give it to me. I don't even care that she doesn't want me to come back to Thistle House. I have called in sick to work. I begged Simon to let me use his car. He wants to come with me, but I told him no. We can't both call in sick. And I want to go alone. Emmy, after all this time, I am bringing home your bride's box. August 15th, 1958. Evening. My dear Emmy, as I write this, the bride's box is just to the right of my bent elbow. I could reach out and run my fingers across it with my other hand if I wanted to. There are signs of neglect on its top, and the hinges have corroded to uselessness. The top doesn't stay on unless you bind it shut, which is how Gwen found it. And Emmy, the drawings are inside, just like you left them. The paper is yellowed, and the sketches have faded, but I can still make out nearly every feature you drew if I look close. The images are a bit ghostly, but not unpleasantly so. It's almost as if you have materialized from beyond the grave to return to me. It's as if you have given the brides back to me, not I who have given them back to you. How like you to look after me, even after all that I did to you. Do you want to know how Gwen came to find them? I was right about her not telling her mum that I had come by before. She didn't tell her. She was afraid her mother would get after her for letting me in. Her mother's overprotectiveness is apparently an enormous bone of contention between them. And between you and me, I think she liked having a secret that she could keep from her mum. I don't approve of it. I'm just saying that's what I think. Anyway, she said she couldn't stop thinking about me after I left. She felt bad for me. And she went back inside the crawl space in the yellow room twice, making sure the bride's box hadn't fallen into a hollow of some kind in the framing. She was in her bedroom, Rose's, thinking about it, when it occurred to her that if our bedroom had a crawl space, maybe the one she was sleeping in did too, and that I had just remembered the room wrong. In her bedroom, a cedar chest lines the far wall. Gwen didn't want to move it when her mother was home. Otherwise she'd hear her pushing it across the floor. So she had to wait a couple of days until her mum had to go to Oxford on business. She emptied the chest and pushed it away from the wall and found an identical crawlspace door. The bride's box was inside, on the framing of the door, just like I had placed it in our bedroom. Rose had found it and put it in her room. I'm sure that was what happened. That wardrobe was on another wall when Rose had the room that Gwen is sleeping in now. Remember how Rose liked your drawings? She must have found the bride's box after we ran away, took it, and put it in her own room. I know it was her, because she wrote her name on the top of all the sketches, Emmy. She wanted the bridal gowns to be hers, so she made them hers in the only way she could. And she obviously never told Charlotte. Gwen didn't want to tell her mum about the discovery, because that would necessitate a conversation about why she went looking for it. And that was why she asked to meet me in the village to give me the box. Oh, Emmy. She seemed so happy to be part of something wonderful that was just hers. Her mum wasn't privy to it, so she couldn't spoil it for her or take it from her. So like you. So like you. I told her so. I told Gwen she reminded me of you, and that I hoped she would change her mind and tell her mother about me and the bride's box. It was our secrets that pulled our worlds apart, Emmy. First yours, and then mine. But Gwen said her mother would have a conniption. They would have a huge fight over it, and in the end, her mother would never leave her alone at the house again. Not at Thistle House, and not in St. Paul when they went back to the States. I offered to come to Thistle House and explain things, but Gwen told me not to. They only have a couple more weeks left before they head back to America. She doesn't want to spend them handcuffed to her mother. I asked her why her mother worries about her so. Gwen said she'd always been that way. She lost family members in the war, her father had told her, and it was too difficult for her to talk about it. I feel for Gwen, poor thing, and I feel for her mother. Terrible things can happen to you that leave you unable to risk trusting the world with what you love. I know this better than anyone. I don't want to live handcuffed to my regrets anymore, Emmy. I hadn't really understood that was how I had been living until Gwen described it that way. I tried one last time to convince her to let me go back to Thistle House and talk to her mum, but Gwen said her mother was in Oxford that day, apparently meeting with a long-lost half-brother, who had contacted her mother out of the blue. I was jealous in an instant, Emmy, that Gwen's mother, could have a long-lost half-brother suddenly crawl out of the folds of the past and reconnect with her. I told her how wonderful that was. But she just shrugged and said it would have been nice to know before now that her mother had a half-brother. I wished her safe travels back to America and a happy life. She seemed sad to see me go. I was strangely sad to leave her. It was a little like saying goodbye to you all over again. October 22, 1958. Dear Remy, I haven't had much luck finding any clothing designers or bridal shop owners interested in your sketches. Make that, I haven't had any luck. The ones I have spoken to have been quite taken by the story of the bride's box, and especially moved by what happened to you and me. They've all found it intriguing that I want to see your sketches become real dresses at last. But the designs aren't in style, said one. The sketches are too faded to be of any use, said another. And they aren't mine to give away or sell, said several others. Technically, they are still your property, Emmy. I wish I knew the name of the person you were to meet the day of the bombing. I remember your telling me how this was your one chance to be discovered. If I knew who that person was, and where to find him or her, I would waste no time in arranging a meeting. I can't remember the name of the lady you worked for at the bridal shop either. The shop is gone. Everything on the street near where the butcher shop was is gone. It's all new buildings now. I will keep trying, Emmy. I haven't given up. In the meantime, Simon and I have set a date, and I am now wearing the engagement ring he tried to give me last spring. Our wedding date is April 7th, your birthday. November 1st, 1958. Dear Emmy, no news to report on the sketches. I found a seamstress willing to make one of the drawings a reality. I've actually found several who make custom dresses all the time, for a pretty price. But the one I like best is not interested in being part of launching a line of wedding dresses with your name on them. She will make a dress for me from one of your designs, but it won't be to sell in a boutique somewhere. It will be for me to wear. I am discovering that if I want your drawings to become real wedding gowns, I will need a treasure chest full of money to fund the project myself, and then peddle them to bridal shops door to door. I don't have a treasure chest full of money. Gramps isn't a rich man, but he's done well. I can only hope I can convince him to help me do with your sketches what you would have done with them. But first, I will have to tell my grandparents about the bride's box. And what I did. Julia. November 9th, 1958. Dear Emmy, Gramps said no. Simon and I took the train to Woodstock and had tea at Granny and Gramps' house this afternoon. Gramps said he was sorry, but neither he nor I know anything about the bridal gown business. We don't have the know-how, the instincts, the connections. He said it would cost thousands of pounds to have your drawings made into dresses, provided I could find a suitable seamstress able to read the faded sketches, and then I would have to traipse around London on foot, carrying them from store to store, hoping some shop owner would want to buy a gown that was in style 20 years ago, designed by an unknown who has disappeared off the face of the earth. Gramps can't see the value of plodding across London with an armload of wedding dresses no one to date has expressed any interest in. He also commented that the designs aren't truly mine to do this with. They belong to you. I don't have your permission, and I'm not likely going to get it. Gramps and Granny were both appreciative of my desire to make things right between you and me, but they don't think I've anything to regret. You and I both made mistakes that day. Mine were less egregious, perhaps, but that's not the point, Gramps said. The point is, London was bombed a few hours after you and I arrived. The war is the true destroyer of your dreams, not I. So it's not up to me to restore what the war shattered. Simon was sitting next to me the whole time, stroking my hand under the table and saying nothing. I wanted him to say, "But Emmy's designs are really good," or, "I'll drive Julia around London so she won't have to tramp across the West End on foot with an armload of dresses," or even just, Don't we owe it to Julia's sister to at least give her dresses a chance?
He didn't. We left soon after that.
What was the good in finding Emmy's sketches, if not to do something with them?
I asked Simon on the way home.
He said maybe the finding was just for me. Maybe I was meant to find the bride's box now, because I happened to be in need of a wedding dress.
Pick the one you want for you, Simon said. Wear one of your sister's designs to your own wedding. Wouldn't that be the good in finding them?
I suppose he's right. I laid out all the sketches on my kitchen table tonight, after Simon dropped me off. The most faded ones I put back. A couple others just weren't right for my body shape. Of the seven that were left, I picked the one I used to call the button dress. Remember it, Emmy? You had tiny pearl buttons going down the front, all the way to the floor, and a high-fitted waist. Lacy sleeves you can see through, a heart-shaped neckline, and a swishy skirt with a lace petticoat underneath. I wonder if you ever imagined that someday your little sister would wear one of your dresses. Perhaps Simon is right. Perhaps finding the bride's box so I can wear one of your designs is what you would have wanted. I am eager to take it to the seamstress who said she will make one of the dresses for me. I know what Gramps will say when I tell him my dress is to be custom-made and might cost a little more than he thought he wanted to spend. He will say he doesn't care. The dress is for me, for my wedding. It's for my happy ending. One of us should have one. I guess it will be me. At least, as happy as I can make it. Julia. November 19th, 1958. Dear Emmy, the seamstress who agreed to make the button dress for me told me she'd like to change the skirt to a T-length and drop the tops of the sleeves to off the shoulder. She said the style of the button dress is terribly outdated. I wanted to throttle her. Instead, I told her I liked the original design just the way it was. She said, "You do know no one is wearing this style of wedding dress anymore." And I said that wasn't true, because I was wearing it. "But I know now why I can't seem to generate interest in your sketches, Emmy. I'm too late. I waited too long to look for the box." Julia. December 2nd, 1958. Dear Emmy, I had my first fitting today. I nearly cried when I tried the dress on, even though it's only partially sewn. It's so beautiful, Emmy. So incredibly beautiful. April seems like such a long way off. Granny came with me to the fitting, and she started to cry. "See how talented my sister was," I said to her as she blotted her tears away. "It's a wonderful dress," Granny said. The seamstress just clucked something like, "Every bride looks like a princess in a wedding gown that she loves." When I came home, I could feel the dress still on my skin. Your dress, Emmy. I still feel it on me, caressing me, holding me. I think I can be happy marrying Simon in the dress that came from the very heart of you. I think you would want me to be happy marrying him. Snow is falling outside my window now. Diamond white in the spreading dusk. I feel you here with me, Emmy. It's as if you are looking down on me from heaven, for surely that is where you are, and the snow is a gift you've been allowed to give me so that I can mark this day. The bride's box is sitting on the table here next to me, and it occurs to me that I shall marry only once. I have no need of the other sketches in the box. I have your forgiveness. I see it in the snow outside my window, and I felt it earlier, when your folds of white caressed my trembling body. Across from me, my little coal fire is whispering condolences. And something else. I see it now. How I can hold you forever, and also let you go. The happy fire is sighing in agreement, the little beggar. It is eager to play its part for me. The journal I will keep to remind me, should I ever need to be reminded, that you and I did indeed find each other again, within the seams of my wedding dress. Goodbye, dear sister. I will love you always. Julia. Chapter 41. Kendra. When I look up from Julia's journal, Isabel is asleep on the sofa. Her head is bent forward on her chest, and a gentle wheeze floats across to me every time she exhales. For several long minutes, I am torn between waking her and letting her sleep. I am dying to know how Isabel got her hands on the journal. She had to have been reunited with her sister. Had to have been. How else could she have come by it? I turn my head toward the window as the thought occurs to me that perhaps Julia is in the garden with the rest of the family. As I ponder this, Isabel stirs awake, sees that I have closed the journal, and she sits up abruptly.
Oh, I must have nodded off. What time is it?
I glance at a clock on the wall behind her. Just a bit after 2:30.
Did you read it?
Yes. She takes the journal gently from my outstretched hand.
You're the first to read it in many years.
How did you get it? I hear urgency in my voice. She smiles knowingly.
Do you mean, did Julia herself give it to me?
I nod, wanting very much to hear that this is exactly what happened. Isabel runs her hand across the top of the journal.
She did.
Relief floods me.
Thank God,
I whisper, and her smile widens.
Yes, I've God to thank for refusing to let me continue with my stubbornness.
How did you find each other? Isabel thinks about her answer for a moment.
Gwen brought us together, you might say.
She finally told you about Julia coming to the house that day, didn't she? I say, sure that this is what happened.
I guess that is one way of looking at it. The short story is, Julia handed the journal to me, from where you are sitting right now. The long story is a bit more complicated than that.
She settles into the sofa cushions behind her, and I settle into mine.
We'd been back in the UK for nearly a year, Mac, Gwen, and I. We decided to stay at Thistle House after Mac joined us that first summer. He and I needed a quiet place to rebuild our marriage, and since Gwen's best friend back in the States had recently moved to the West Coast, Gwen was amenable to staying and trying the high school here. I soon had other reasons for wanting to stay, which I will get to. But I still lived as though Emmeline Downtree had never existed. I still went by the name Isabel. I didn't see any great need to shatter the myth. And being back at Thistle House after so many years was rekindling old eggs that I thought Isabel could handle better. The only person who deserved to know the truth was Gwen. And what was the point in finally confessing to her that not only was I living my life with a borrowed name, but I had also abandoned my 7-year-old half-sister on the day the Germans bombed London, and she was likely dead because of me. I was looking for ways to bond with Gwen rather than distance myself from her. And since Mac hadn't taken the news well when I finally told him the truth about who I was, it was easy to decide that nothing good would come from dredging it up for Gwen either. So the three of us were in Oxford on a Sunday afternoon, the following April, for an art exhibition. Gwen and I had made some progress in our relationship, and she was fairly happy at Thistle House, and with a new friend she had made. Things between Mac and me had improved, too, which was why the two of them had decided to come with me to this show. The Umbrella Girls had taken off, as the saying goes, and were selling well. The original was still hanging in Charlotte's old bedroom at Thistle House. And strangely enough, it was the one daily reminder of Julia that didn't sting. It had quite the opposite effect, actually, which was why I was inspired to create more.
My eyes are naturally drawn to the Umbrella Girl painting hanging behind her. Painting Julia over and over was like finding her, I venture. Isabel nods slowly.
Perhaps it was. Painting the Umbrella Girls was definitely therapeutic, and selling them made me feel that at last I had something to give back to the world. She draws a deep breath before continuing. Anyway, Mac had bought a London newspaper to read over lunch that afternoon at the art show. When he was finished with it, Gwen began thumbing through the sections. She stopped at a page and said, "Well, would you look at that?" And I asked her what she had seen. She folded the section over to isolate a picture. From upside down, I could see that it was a wedding photo. "I guess I can tell you this now," Gwen said, "if you promise not to go crazy." And I said, "Tell me what?" As she handed the paper to me, Gwen said that way back when we first came to Stowe, the woman in the wedding photo had come to Thistle House on a day I had been out. But Kendra, I heard nothing after those first few words. I was now looking at a photograph of a bridal gown I had only ever seen in my head. Buttons down the front, fitted bodice, sleeves of illusion. The dress was one of my gowns. And then I looked at the face of the happy bride. The woman was Julia. "Oh my God," I murmur. "Indeed," Isabel said. "You see, too, what lengths God had to go to reunite me with her. He had to practically move heaven and earth to undo all my mistakes." "What did you do?" I ask. "Well, I had to have Gwen repeat everything she'd said, because I had heard none of it. And I did go a little crazy, which she had asked me not to do. Mac, who was looking at someone else's paintings nearby, rushed over to see what I was fussing about. I thrust the paper toward him, and through my sobs, said who it was in the photo. I had not uttered Julia's name in a very long time. Mac kept saying, 'Are you sure?' But there was no mistaking that dress. And that face, even 20 years after I had last seen it. And of course, the bride in the photo, the former Julia Waverley, had known about the bride's box. This Julia was my Julia."
"So you looked her up? You contacted her?"
Stunned at the play of events, I am already picturing the sisters in a tearful embrace. Isabel pauses to inhale deeply, as if the memory of that day still took her breath away. "I asked Mac to get in touch with her. I didn't know what Julia's feelings would be toward me, though I should have guessed that wearing one of my dresses at her wedding was evidence that she did not hate me. But I could not lift the phone to call her when Mac found out where she was. It wasn't difficult for him to locate her. The announcement in the newspaper said the couple both worked at the same map-making company in London. The hardest part was waiting for Monday to arrive, so that Mac could ring up this place and ask for her. I didn't want to be in the house when he called her. I stood at the edge of the pond while he and she talked. When he joined me outside a few minutes later, he said Julia had wept with joy to hear that I was alive, and that she and her husband would be driving out to Thistle House the next day. I sank to my knees on the wet grass, as overcome with emotion as I had been the day I lost her. Gwen had come out with Mac, and she dropped beside me, begging me to forgive her for not telling me that Julia had been to the house nearly a year before. But I knew Gwen owed me no apology. Everything was suddenly bright as a July noon, even though rain clouds spanned the horizon that morning. It was as if a great curtain that had been strung above me had fallen into a heap on the ground, and the sky was aflame with light. I could clearly see that fear and regret had made me so protective of Gwen. She had felt as if she were suffocating. That she had had no desire to tell me about a stranger who had been by inquiring about a box of sketches had been my fault, not hers. And my inability to forgive myself for what I had done had made Julia an anonymous shadow to Gwen, a ghost whose name I had never said nor allowed Mac to say. Gwen owed me nothing.
Isabel pauses a moment, as though gathering strength from the seconds of silence.
I couldn't sleep the night before Julia was to come, so I had plenty of quiet hours to ponder my new reality. I had been Isabel longer than I had been Emmy, you see. No one knew me by any other name, and I had my umbrella girls by then. Emmy was no one. When Mac had reached out to Julia for me, he had to tell her who I had become, who I was, and who I wasn't. I shake my head. But it's not true that Emmy was no one. You're Emmy. Am I? Isabel looks intently into my eyes, as if seeking affirmation of some kind. Of course you are. None of this would have mattered if underneath that name you stole, you weren't who you've always been. Isabel breaks into a wide smile. She looks like a proud parent whose child has figured something out.
Right you are, Kendra. Right you are. But you can already guess. I have been slow to realize what should have been clear to me the second I saw Julia again.
She cocks her head to one side, and I can see that she is remembering the moment she saw her sister after nearly 2 decades. I wait for her to tell me what it was like. A few moments later, she does.
Mac led her into this room. I was sitting right here where I am now. She was so tall and beautiful. Taller than me, and looking so much like Mum. So very much like Mum. She wore a dress of pink, with a ruby pendant at her neck. Had I passed her in the street and not seen her face, I might not have known her. But her eyes were locked on mine, and they were Julia's eyes. She ran into my arms as though no time had passed, as though she was simply rising from the sofa where I had left her, and there had been no war, no slow waltz of time, no silent years of longing. She was a little girl inside a grown woman's body, putting her arms around my neck and saying the name Mum had given me, Emmy, over and over.
Isabella's looking past me, into that long-ago moment. A tear is slipping down my cheek, and I finger it away.
That was the happiest day of my life, Kendra. I did not think I would ever live to see the heaviness of losing Julia lifted from me.
I wait for her to tell me more. Several seconds later, she continues.
I was Emmy to her, not Isabel. I really didn't know how to be Emmy to anyone else. Julia seemed to understand that I became Isabel so that I might find her, and I stayed Isabel so that I would be able to live with myself when finding her proved impossible. She told me she had her own ways of coping with her mistakes, and then she handed me the journal she had written to me.
Isabel raises her gaze to meet mine.
The journal answered many questions for me, and yet it raised new ones. If only I had gone to Mrs. Billingsley for help, or answered the door when her butler came to the flat. Either one would have told me that Thea had taken Julia to Neville's parents, and wouldn't I have been able to find her from the start? Or if I had remembered Mum had gotten that letter from Neville's parents, wouldn't I have thought to look for it in the flat after Julia disappeared? Would I have figured out that since the letter was missing, someone had taken it? Or if I had been honest with Gwen from the start about who I really was, wouldn't she have known that the woman who came to Thistle House inquiring about an old box of bridal sketches was the sister that I had lost? Or if I had never tried to sneak away with those sketches in the first place, wouldn't Mum have lived?
I see her terrible logic, but I also see that a larger force had been at work. There was a war, I venture. She nods slowly. Yes.
Strangely enough, war has a way of absolving us of the mistakes we make while in its dreadful shadow. But it keeps this absolution a secret. I didn't realize I was playing my cards against a cruel opponent that had its own cards to play.
We are quiet for a moment. So you remained Isabel, then, I say. Even after you and Julia were reunited. Isabel nods.
To all but family, yes. What is a name, really, but letters on a page,
or a sound on the tongue. To the rest of the world, I was Isabel McFarland, wife of the American